Levi from New York. Our sequential encounters have all been related to conferences so far, often at the annual meeting of the College Art Association, where Alan has been president for several years. I remember that we met one other time in Paris on the occasion of the annual conference launched by the Society for Literature and Science, where Alan gave a talk about complex simulations of evolution, a topic so characteristic for her deep involvement in questions of the interrelations between art and science. As an artist, foremost, Alan has continued in her own work to address the systemic interconnections and historical overlaps within the cultural paradigms of art and science. With this extraordinary orientation of her work, it might retrospectively not be surprising that in 1985, she received an arts commission from the NASA. Her fascinating works received six solo shows and have been exhibited widely both in the US and abroad. And as an artist, she has been honored with many grants, fellowships, and prizes, which I cannot possibly list all now due to our tight time frame, but I do want to mention that she participated in a number of art as well as science exhibitions. Among these, Petroliana at the Second Moscow Biennial, Weather Report, Art and Climate Change at the Boulder Museum of Contemporary Art, and Gregor Mendel Planting the Seeds of Genetics at the Field Museum in Chicago. Alan Levi was guest editor of special issue at the of the Art Journal with the title Contemporary Art and the Genetic Code, and she contributed to numerous publications involved with art, biotechnology, and evolution. In the past, she taught at Brooklyn College and Cooper Union in New York, and currently she's a visiting scholar at NYU. And I was surprised to read also in your updated CV that you're currently completing a doctorate at ZNode Zurich on art and neuroscience. So maybe you can give us some more information about that later. So thank you very much, Alan, for your for coming to Cologne, and I would like you all now to welcome our guest, Alan Levi.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. I'm delighted to be here. Unlike many of those assembled, as you've just heard, my point of view is that of an artist rather than a historian of either science or art. I emerged as an artist during the 1960s, and that's how and why I became interested in Kubler's work. It allowed me essentially to buck some of the formalist inclinations of the 1960s and choose a different set of artistic ancestors. Kubler was well ahead of his time, which is why we're here today, in the understanding of what has been identified by many as complex systems. My argument today is that two experiments conducted roughly 10 years before his publication were pivotal to the impact of his work today. And for those who might have read my article on Kubler in the Art Journal fairly recently, I'm taking this in a somewhat different direction on the grounds that many of you will have read the other. As a result of the convergences that have been going on, his writing is newly relevant to emerging forms of new media and bioart and to studies in cultural evolution. One of these two pivotal moments, of course, was Watson and Crick's discovery of the structure of DNA in 1953. When Kubler had published The Shape of Time, only 10 years had passed since Watson and Crick's elucidation of the structure of the genetic code, and the scientific rule of thumb we all learned was that DNA yields RNA yields protein. Not only has this unidirectional flow since been challenged by the findings of prions and RNA viruses, but our current approach to biology considers the role of time in molecular biology, examining flows of information between nucleic acids and from them to proteins and control of gene expression through negative feedback and switches. The second experiment was that of Stanislav Ulam and John von Neumann, who explored the possibility of machine replication and conducted a computer experiment with automata based on the changing states of the cells in an infinite grid. A cellular automaton is a formal construction with universal computing power equivalent to a Turing machine. Besides being one of the many theoretically equivalent computational devices, cellular automata are of particular interest in the study of complex systems because of their simplicity and expressive power. The objections that Kubler voiced in The Shape of Time to understanding historical change no longer hold, and I'm going to show you some of these developments. So my outline is that first I'll show some of the developments in visual culture and science since his publication. For the second, I'll look at the developments in the history of science that enable comparisons between the evolution of artifacts and biological evolution, where they're similar and where they're different, and then some of the recent developments in art. And then, of course, I'll give some conclusions about this. To give one definition of complex system, this is one supplied by Yair Bar-Yam, director of the New England Complexity Institute. He says, the basis of the complex systems approach to the study of the world is the idea that both objects and behaviors are universal, that systems that at first appear to be different, in fact, often share similar properties and behaviors. So we'll start with part one, developments in visual culture and science. Kubler, of course, starts by saying, let us suppose that the idea of art can be expanded to embrace the whole range of man-made things, including all tools and writing, in addition to the useless, beautiful, and poetic things of the world. So in The Shape of Time, Kubler considered how an artifact evolves within material culture. This concerns the order of cultural symbols, but also other factors. Objects such as tools and vessels are shaped by cost, by ease of manufacture, by economic problems, by the availability of particular materials within a region, by the practical function they are to perform, by the traditions that are passed on, and by a mix of affordances that, as Cyril Stanley Smith and others have shown, Cyril Stanley Smith, the metallurgist, come into being through a fashioning of materials, or in other words, through bodily handling. So now we must see, my thesis here is that we must see Kubler's thesis in the context of contemporary art and art history's increasing dissolution of boundaries, reformulations, and the new forms of art. Some of the questions Kubler's book prompts us to ask are, how have artifacts come to be viewed as art? African, oceanic, and pre-Columbian mass and figure sculptures have gone, all of these have gone from being artifacts to art. How did this happen? European painters and sculptors are commonly held to have ignited an aesthetic interest and appreciation in them, but the story's far more than that. We have changing contexts and, of course, Duchamp, and this could take us in a whole other direction. The second question, how were these artifacts distributed? According to Forrest Colburn, prominent Mexican artists such as Diego Rivera and Covarrubias very publicly collected and displayed pre-Columbian artifacts. Other Mexicans collected pre-Columbian artifacts too, as did expatriates living in the country. An art market sprang up, both in Mexico and the United States. The third question, what range of references does pre-Columbian art offer contemporary art? What are contemporary artists doing with this subject? And I'll show you some mythic references and then very political ones. Finally, are our assumptions of earlier cultures correct? This changing status of artifacts to art can be seen in the next few slides. These are two cylinder seals from Ecuador, dating from the 9th to 15th century, and one flat seal from the 1st to 5th centuries that were exhibited at the Princeton Art Museum in 2005, and thus evolved in time into categories of fine art. The first pre-Columbian artifacts to enter public collections in the U.S. were housed in natural history museums like the Peabody Museum and the American Museum of Natural History. The next image, I have a Toltec panel from Mexico, a gift of the painter Frederick Church in 1893, which had been on display at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, along with Aztec stone sculptures that it purchased. This one depicts an eagle devouring a human heart. So what range of references does pre-Columbian art offer contemporary art? These are works probably you all know by Alfred Jensen, entitled Mayan Temple on the left and Research in a Growth Hormone, both painted around 1962, so they're really contemporaneous with Kubler. Marcia Tucker, who was the founder of the New Museum in New York, gave Jensen a show, and in writing about him, she drew attention to the resonance that Kubler had for Jensen. Jensen was born in Guatemala and frequently referenced Mayan calendrical systems and quotations from ancient systems of divination. But he also was very interested in contemporary science, and he merged these epistemologies. Perhaps the artist most studied with respect to Kubler has been Robert Smithson. This is a page of Smithson's writings that includes his comments about the shape of time. In it, Smithson includes a broad range of phenomena, including pyramids and ziggurats, modernist literary criticism, classical physics and science fiction. Clearly, there are many ways that artists have reappropriated older art. Maybe in terms of his sequences, here is one. This is a political transformation, challenging ideas about conquest, colonialism, and race. Castor paintings were done, and they were totally transformed in the work of an artist I'll show next, who's contemporary. Castor paintings portray images of race in 18th century Mexico. These works chart a specific taxonomic progression with the Spaniard at the apex of the socioeconomic and racial caste structure. And it took as its subject the colonial issue of race. Some art history has reoriented itself to focus on visual culture, studying secular works such as maps, textiles, silverwork portraits, and these castor paintings in addition to religious work. And this is the artist I'm referring to. This is work by contemporary Inigo Manglano Ovalle. This artist sometimes incorporates castor paintings into his installations. He portrays himself within the castor matrix as a mestizo, but turns the original use inside out. His theme is political and social upheaval, and he means to offer a new model of race relations. My third question was, are our assumptions about earlier cultures correct? We see evidence of the past in the present, even with respect to the conquest of Mexico. In 1693, a painting of the Virgin of Montserrat was completed by Francisco Chivantito. The Chinchero painting highlights how aspects of Spanish culture were incorporated into their daily and ceremonial life. And here you can see a close-up of the Virgin of Montserrat. The portrayal of, according to Stella Neer, this portrayal of indigenous men in the Chinchero painting provides key insights into the material culture of the residents, especially how the body was adorned and how class and ethnicity were articulated. Here, indigenous elites, as well as indigenous commoners, draw from Pan-Andean, Inca, and Spanish material culture to represent class status. Her point is that Inca architecture continued well into the colonial period and that it was as adaptive and creative as it was during imperial Inca times. And this next is also the image, an image of Stella Neer, who claims that the Spanish and mestizo categories do not sufficiently encompass all of the architecture built during the Spanish occupation of the Andes. The use of Spanish-style motifs in Inca architecture of the colonial period also highlights the issue of change. Until recently, the prevailing view has been that Inca architecture did not change. This belief was based, according to Stella Neer, on an analysis of, not on an analysis of the evidence, but in an antiquated assumption in Western scholarship that indigenous cultures were essentially static. Therefore, scholars tended to interpret change in colonial indigenous material culture as a loss of once pure traditions rather than as adaptation to evolving contexts. As Kubler described in The Shape of Time, when the conquistadors invaded, their newer technology displaced the old. As they colonized foreign land, they insisted that the conquered Indians renounce their existing methods of building and decoration and replicate that of the victors. But these replications in turn became subject to local adaptations and alterations, creating variation from which a selection was made. And here, let me go back to that last, that's okay. The point that Stella Neer makes further was from the evidence. Stella Neer was able to determine that many of the walls lining streets were made after 1532, and in addition, remnants of a series of parallel imperial Inca walls and finely made building were found embedded in the fabric of the colonial era street. My next part, which is the longest I'm really going into, here I'm saying that developments in science and the history of science have enabled comparisons to be made between the evolution of artifacts and biological evolution, although they're flawed and limited. What is the artifact model of design? The following is based on an account of Tim Lewins. They reflect ideas of adaptationism, developmentalism, constructivism, internalism, and externalism. Adaptationism stresses function, suggests teleology, stresses selective forces at work and selection of a trait. Developmentalism or structuralism stresses form and power of physical constraints, It downplays natural selection. It emphasizes what is physically possible for an organism to achieve in development. Organisms share morphogenic fields which adhere to universal laws of form, although I'm not sure it's the same kind of morphogenesis referred to by the last speaker. I'm thinking more of D'Arcy Thompson versus Darwin. Constructivism suggests that niches arise out of activity. It is opposed to adaptationism. Organisms are not the passive objects of external forces, but instead modulate and create these forces. The organism does things, in other words, to increase its own fitness. And then last, internalism, which stresses the intrinsic properties, and externalism, which stresses the role of selection and the environment. An example often given is when air pollution changed the color of trees to become darker, that the color of moths then darkened. And this has been objected to on the grounds that the moth has a lot of other options. It could secrete a chemical that interferes with predation, or it could move to a totally different environment. The question then becomes, what parts of the environment are open to alteration by an organism? Here, the subject of constraints become important. In the case of moths, we conclude that the moth's developmental system does not make the secretion of tree-changing chemicals a possibility. So these accounts of internalism and externalism hinge on whether changes in morphology can be best predicted by facts about the environment or facts about development. Our ideas of artifacts and design are changing. Among those who have pointed out the relevance of evolutionary theory to the history of designed artifacts are Pai, Bisella, Dawkins, Langrish, Michael, Jonas, Yagu. There's a lot, and the list goes on. To remind people here, probably know this, Kubler endorsed 5 points. It's really the first two that are the most important for my talk: the need to bring together the history of science and the history of art, which opens up the question of Kubler's relationship with Kuhn, which is what I largely explored in my article in the Art Journal. Kubler sees art as a problem-solving activity. Kuhn's paradigm shift is often seen as an alternative to an evolutionary account of cultural change with organicist and cyclical metaphors of style, efflorescence, decay, and rebirth. Kuhn describes the paradigm shift as itself undergoing an evolutionary sequence: emergence, normal science, crisis, followed by revolution. And Kubler's second point, the irrelevance to the purposeful nature of artistic invention of metaphors of biology and cyclical happening. Teleology has been challenged today. It can be made operative in the biology of systems biology, and it can be made inoperative in art. You could use algorithms, you could use any number of means to bring about an unforeseen end. In addition, in terms of artifacts, these once designed to be used particular ways can give way to new uses not conceived by the person who first made them. Mathematician Norbert Wiener, one of the founders of cybernetics, suggested that living organisms be viewed as systems governed by feedback control. But in Wiener's own time, molecular biology could not attain a systems-level understanding. The current field of systems biology is focused on the mathematical modeling and simulation of complex interactions among components of an organism that are viewed as part of one system. The field has developed strategies to construct biological systems having desired properties, and in this sense, biological systems can be considered, even can be considered purposeful, based on definite design principles and simulations instead of blind trial and error runs. Kubler asks whether artifacts possess a specific kind of duration, occupying time differently from the animal beings of biology and the natural materials of physics. Artifacts provided Kubler with another way to relate the history of science to art history through considerations of technology's backdoor influences on science. For Kubler, inventions are purposeful solutions to problems. And Kubler stated that artists and scientists resemble each other more as artisans than as intellectuals, and that they are most alike when they are fashioning their instruments. So the question we're asking is, in fact, the evolution of artifacts like biological evolution in major ways. And on top, I have one of Darwin's maps that you will all be familiar with. And the other one, done before Darwin, on the bottom, was a map of languages where people were trying to flesh out some of the evolutionary sequences. What you see on this slide now is work by Raymond Lowry, who's made a chart comparing fashions and industrial and technological changes. One of the very intriguing passages in Kubler's book is when, immediately following his account of the Mexican conquest, he shifts gears to talk about the cycles of shifts in fashion that take place, quote, on another scale of magnitude. To me, his sequence of thought here, which is so abrupt, suggests that he was considering how to correlate phase shifts with concepts of feedback frequency. One of the concerns of complexity science is to investigate under what circumstances events are likely to either be magnified through feedback or instead dissipate. As Peerback and Kan Chen demonstrated decades later after his book, with the simulation of avalanches, a particular grain of sand can land on a specific spot on a sand pile, thus causing either a large avalanche or pass unnoticed altogether. Kubler recognized that a model of historical change would need to be applicable to both revolutions and fads, depending upon a range of factors and contingencies. So I was referring mostly to the chart on the left, but you can also see that on the next slide, what you see is the Burlington Zephyr ad showing the evolution of transportation moving from ox cart to horse-drawn covered wagon through steam-powered locomotives to the superior streamliner engine of the day. And the lower image is again Raymond Lowry's redesign of the Greyhound bus logo, showing his decreasing the physical bodily bulk of the animal. So there are some people, and I don't know what the reality of this is, but some people feel that there was a suggestion here that the simplified streamlined forms were related in some way to eugenics and to fashioning a better society and designing humans for greater beauty. And the bulk that you see on the lower image here shows that the sleekness is meant to characterize intelligent bodies that prioritize brains over brawn. Here's another example of depicting cultural evolution. And this is owned by the historian Henry Petrosky, the engineer. To look at the history of invention is to see dynamic, unstable, and competitive streams of influences revealing complex adaptive systems in action. Here you see a chart of paperclips. Artifacts reveal how novel, innovative, or adaptive utilizations may lead to a breakup of constraints, yielding unpredictable results. Within the context of complex systems, Kubler's form classes, linked in formal sequences, may be seen as equivalent to the various solutions and adaptive improvements that typify the history of innovation. Stuart Kaufman's observation, he observed, with regard only first to biological evolution, that increases in diversity proceed by early diversification at higher taxonomic levels, followed by later diversification at lower taxonomic levels. His hypothesis was that you could make a comparison that was legitimate between biological and technological evolution, and that they both proceeded by early diversification at higher taxonomic levels, followed by later diversification at lower taxonomic levels. So you can see that if this method is true, this gives you a way with respect to the artifacts of actually locating an attempt to locate a methodology that would be true in some sense to what Kubler was doing. And they put this to the test, Kaufman and a group of complexity scientists. And what they looked at was the evolution of a bicycle wheel. Kaufman argues that this macroevolutionary pattern results from the increased cost of exploring distant locations in design space as evolution proceeds, and is an expected outcome of any process of adaptive evolution. He further states that the design history of bicycles matches this pattern. Kaufman proposed, as I already said, that bicycle evolution was similar to biological evolution, early diversification followed by standardization on a limited number of designs. Petrosky, Norman, and Michael stress the importance of failures in design history. They also stress the importance of the interface. Returning again to biological evolution, adaptive radiation, such as seen in this slide of Darwin's finches, is when speciation rates exceed extinction rates, resulting in a diversity of life, as we saw during the Cambrian explosion. The result is that evolution tends to produce new lower-level taxa within the population of surviving higher taxa. The basic idea is that mutations occurring early in development cause many downstream changes and so are relatively unlikely to produce viable organisms. But mutations occurring later in development cause fewer downstream changes. Aspects of an organism that are laid down early in development have a high generative entrenchment, as we all know, because they're less likely to be altered in the course of evolution. Kaufman proposes three natural timescales, and these are applicable to artifacts. An early phase, where evolution occurs by a long jump to distant location, a middle phase, where further evolution occurs by short jumps, affecting a kind of hill climbing, and a late phase of relative stasis and improbable jumps. And then they look at the diversity of 19th century bicycle designs, and all of these are from roughly 1850 to 1884. And on the next stop, you can on the next slide, you'll see to what extent they followed this through. They constructed a fitness landscape. that shows the changing fitness of different bicycle designs over time, where the x-axis is the diversity of designs from indirect to direct transmission, the y-axis is the time scale, and the fitness is seen in the isolated hills, or if they're adjacent, then that. The main interest in making this picture, making this figure, was to look at Kaufman's wider framework of understanding dynamic systems. The scientists wished to see if the patterns of co-evolving dynamic ecosystems, such as the bicycle society system, show periods of stability, progressive complication, transitions with critical fluctuations to new states, and whether they evolve to the state of chaos. The system that they used in principle was similar to that devised by Linnaeus to classify biological organisms, and it's called a phonetic system and is built on observed similarities and differences of form, in other words, morphogenics, rather than descent. This taxonomy classifies bicycles according to their morphological and technological attributes. So the way that would be for bicycles would be the number of wheels, the type of transmission, which wheel is the drive wheel, etc. And this is a chart, a generatively entrenched chart of bicycle wheels charted according to such features as the number of wheels, drive transmission types, and linkages. How am I doing on time here? Half through, young. The next image shows the taxonomy with examples of leaf node occupants and records the first and last known dates of production of that design. They do not take the numbers produced into account, but only the duration when a given taxon was organized by one or more bicycles. And these are clade diversity diagrams. So you can see how really complete the methodology is. A clade is a group of organisms, such as a species, whose members share homologous features derived from a common ancestor. Homologous means having the same evolutionary origin, but not the same function necessarily. And on the left is a biological clade diagram showing the changing number of genera within an order, and it is contrasted on the right with a chronological taxonomic diversity diagram. The result confirms Kaufman's prediction of early diversification followed by extinction and relative stasis. And I have this on not only because it was by a quote by Dozanski, but the quote took place in 1963 when Kubler published, and he wrote, "The genetic basis of man's capacity to acquire, develop, or modify and transmit culture emerged because of the adaptive advantages which this capacity conferred." I'm going to go rather quickly through some of these. This is a chart where culture is mapped onto biology. And on the next slide, I return to Kubler's form class. Within each sequence, prime objects and vast masses of replicas are to be discovered. And he compares these to mutant genes to generate change. Well, we now know that cultural adaptation is both a cognitive and behavioral process. Cognition involves generating information, storage, and the transmission of information. Behavioral decisions result from perceptions of the environment. So there's a feedback loop involving three units: environment, cognition, and behavior. The question, how does science explain cultural evolution today? What kinds of adaptive strategies do we see in man-made objects? Some of the factors to consider are competitive exclusion, hybridization, and accommodation. The kind of model Kubler sought needed to account for continuity and discontinuity. And this could be considered that he was talking about affective regularities. Murray Gell-Mann, director of the Santa Fe Institute, claims exact repetition is onerous and total variation is chaotic. So ideally, you're looking for a space between them. In order to find mechanisms of change and quantification, which are needed to make a science of historical change, the key to this for Kubler were the prime objects. Now, I will show the next few slides just partly because of the person who developed this and who disagrees somewhat with the conclusions of Kaufman. And this is Niles Eldridge. He is an amateur musician, and he decided to do an evolution of cornets because he's collected them his whole life. And he came to his discovery of punctuated equilibrium with Stephen Jay Gould in 1972, which proposed that evolution occurs not as a gradual process, but with long periods of inactivity, punctuated by short, sharp bursts of change. And he wanted to apply the same analytical tools that he was using to study the trilobites to see whether he could find the same patterns in his cornets. He owns examples of every conceivable pattern that cornet makers have invented over 200 years, and he owns more than 500 instruments. There are short-belled cornets and long-belled ones. Some have fixed pipes, others are movable. And there are two different theories that George Gaylord Simpson offers about schools of thought about species as distributions of different states of morphological characters assumed to be evolving and as distributions of taxa. Of course, genetic change is known not to be closely correlated with morphological change. And this is of interest to Eldridge. He states that under orthodox Darwinian notions, morphology is related to the ecological niche occupation, since species morphology is adaptive. In other words, what matters is the relationship between the evolution of morphology and the evolution of diversity. For Gould and for Eldridge both, the important step is to recognize that the basic species are distinguished by a number of specific attributes which tend not to change inexorably as time goes on. Instruments like the trumpet and French horn have basically stemmed from a single design, but this was not true of the cornet. Between 1825, when the cornet was invented, and 1875, essentially we had the equivalent of the Cambrian explosion in music. Totally new valves, curves, and branches came about. And the next is, I will show you, are some of the charts that he made from a database of 200 makers of cornets, 123 distinct models. As the collection grew, he realized that the basic cornet designs are packages of information, of cultural material information, similar to species in the biological realm. However, the big difference was that for man-made objects, we're talking about lateral transmission, which was, by the way, according to Carl Wurth, true of biological evolution in the beginning. It started with horizontal lateral transmission. One of the reasons that that Eldridge undertook this was to challenge people who believed in intelligent design. But as he points out, Not only is the difference that biological systems have vertical transmission, but makers of artifacts copy each other, and patents afford only fleeting protection. So biological, as I just said, biological systems predominantly have vertical transmission. The next image I'll show you shows the transmission of ideas. Valverdin Sol found not only that theoretical and computational methods can be applied to study evolutionary processes, but you could apply this to citations, citation theory, specifically in patents. For example, computer simulations provide evidence of universal features in the evolution of both artificial and natural systems. And then I go into a little bit how these influences work. There are no genetic constraints to manufactured objects, and you can't tell in advance what will sell. They're also constrained by exigencies of manufacture. From this, I segued a little bit into patents, just so you could see the relationship of one patent to another. These are charts that journalist and historian of science Betty Ann Kellis and I constructed together to show branches of descent. And we went into the history of artifacts for several years and wrote an article on this. At this point, very quickly, I'm going to show you some of the recent developments in contemporary art. And again, these pertain to the two experiments we saw in 1953. This is a work by Brian Lytle that relies on diffusion reactions to create patterns. In the 1960s, when Kubler wrote, it was difficult to imagine how order could be explained without central agency. This is a work by John Simon Jr., who uses cellular automata. But although I'm only showing you one example in the next slide, I wanted to show you that in this particular example, he mated these icons together to see whether he could do something akin to Darwinian evolution. And he realized that there was no way to program in a fitness function. And this shows the noise that tends to increase. He says the problem explicitly is that it's very hard to describe the fitness function in computer code in a way that does not predetermine the outcome. I put these on just because I thought you might be curious to see how this played out in my own artwork. And this shows, if you could read it, you would see the patents embedded there, and it has to do with the industries controlling oil in the Arctic. So we see the changing roles of artists in museums, where art has become less the object of study than the means of study. Are art museums becoming obsolete, or are they moving in the direction of cultural museums of anthropology? I think that's one of the questions we're here to look at today. And many of you will have seen some of these shows, especially I know the show Korpervelten opened here. Many people are aware that some artists called bioartists are actually generating new forms of life using recombinant DNA methods. And I've included Eduardo Katz here and put him next to a pet that was manufactured, another artifact, a living artifact now, to where the green fluorescent protein was inserted so that these fish would glow in the dark. They were outlawed for people who are interested in California, not on the grounds of artists or people using rDNA methods, but for the trivial use, not because they were afraid of having fish get out into the natural environment. This is also an artwork by Zurin Katz, who are Australian artists, who have set up a school of tissue culture. And this was in also a kind of living artifact, a semi-living form that was displayed at MoMA. And I compared it with a depiction of a form in Rite of Derby, so you can see how what was once metaphorical has now become literal. So my conclusion, the evolution of artifacts can be seen as sharing many similarities to biological evolution as informed by complexity science. They are, however, dissimilar in major respects with respect to form, function, and operational process. And as I had said before, part of the problem is that something that you started out for a particular reason can then be changed to a totally different one. And also you have a break because you have retroactivity. You can take an earlier design and then use it again. So what are the gains? What are we doing today? Breaking down some of the artificial barriers between art and science, although there are definitely differences between them. But we are pointing out some of the commonalities between patterns, methodologies, and structures, and showing the limitations of canonical thinking. What are the changes since Kubler wrote his book? In art, new media art and bioart, which are the most technologically advanced art forms, are recasting nature through novel artistic approaches to issues of emergence, qualia, and classification. And artists are now involved in the two branches that developed from the initial 1953 investigations, the cellular automata and the DNA. In art history, we see visual culture developing alongside art history, with the ability of artists to use imaging methods to see deep into the living cell and simulate biological processes, and now to fashion new life forms, biology has become newly relevant to the history of art. Science today is no longer viewed as separate from culture. Contrary to Kubler's belief in the early 1960s that biology, with its cycles of birth, death, and rebirth, was largely irrelevant to understanding art historical periodicity, nonlinear dynamical systems have brought about a new understanding of biology and of time that has already had an impact on art. Eric Parenz from the Hastings Center asks whether there should be, in principle, any limits on our capacity to transform ourselves and the rest of the natural world. And I think how we answer that question will also show Kubler's influence, whether it continues or dies down. I further would argue today that Kubler's position with regard to historical change in art is somewhat similar to D'Arcy Thompson, the morphologist, who wrote on growth and form in 1917. And I mean similar to his position with regard to Thompson's ideas of biological evolution, which has in fact recently taken on aspects of neo-Darwinism, in that both emphasize the morphology and constraints over meanings and adaptations. Thank you.